low hangover roadway, but generally a stainless steel whip antenna, which is what these antennas of, can generally take without getting damaged.
Component by way of the poor man's choke, ferrite beads, or the coils of cable, you've created an impedance of 5,000 ohms if you've done it right. So in other words, you're launching a signal onto a piece of outside diameter cable that acts like 50 ohms, and it suddenly sees this lumped impedance of 5,000 ohms. Will the signal go beyond that? Yes, but only 1% of it. 5,000 versus 50, I think it's 100-to-1 ratio. So only 1% of the current will go beyond that point. You've done an RF choking job. You've choked off 99% of the current. Therefore, the rest of the cable isn't there electronically beyond that choke.
Did you tell them about these pancakes today or what? Is that why you're repeating yourself again and over and over again?
The dipole itself always
crosses itself.
It's this balance condition. And so in order to live with that balance condition, you've got to make sure that the rest of the cable is not electronically part of the antenna. The rest of the cable being up of the antenna will change the tuning of the antenna. The antenna, if it's electronically connected to the outside shield of the cable, it now is changing the resonant frequency of the dipole. So there's a whole lot of reasons why you don't want to do that. It's not going to smoke and burn. It's not going to stop operation, but it's a more sophisticated operation if you create that RF choke. Does that make it a little bit more clear, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. But if you're choking off 1% of the RF coming down, what becomes of the other 99%? It reflects back?
You could say it never went there in the first place. If you're trying to launch current, say for instance I've got my transmitter normally feeding a 50-ohm cable, and as an experiment, I put a 5,000-ohm resistor in series with the center conductor going back to the transmitter. Therefore, the signal the transmitter is trying to create never gets launched into the cable. It never left the transmitter. In your particular case, you could say that the signal going down the outside of the cable never gets launched. The dipole is acting like a transmitter in the reverse direction. It never gets a chance to launch the signal because the 5,000-ohm impedance is essentially an open circuit. You can't launch power into an open circuit. I know this is not super clear the first time you hear it. Over to you, Steve, K2LIW.
It's 2QAQ, the comment deck.
Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, so then basically what you're saying is that it appears as though the shield is not even there to the second half of the dipole. Because I was just curious, if it was reflected, would it make a difference where the loops or the ferrite beads were placed? You know, would you want that to be, you know, a certain distance so that, you know, the portion from the antenna back to the ballon could radiate and would radiate, you know, would be in resonance, and anything beyond it wouldn't. But if you're saying the shield in its entirety would appear as though it's not there, then I guess it doesn't really matter where you do it. Is that a true statement? KD2HUC.
Dick, explain to him that it's not doing tuning, that it's just decoupling common modes as imbalance. KQIQ.
Yeah, Glenn's on the right track here. You want this RF choke to be as close to the dipole as possible. If the signal that the dipole is trying to launch down the outside of the cable can't go anywhere, because 1 inch downrange you've got this RF choke, you've only lit up 1 inch of coax cable. And if you're doing this at 40 meters where the wavelength is 132 feet, and you've got 1 inch of extra resonator there, so to speak, you're spitting in the ocean, nothing is happening. You want the RF choke to be as close to the dipole as possible. If you put it 10 feet downrange, then you've got 10 feet of radiating coax. And that 10 feet of coax cable radiating is going to give you some grief when it comes to the tuning of the dipole. Does that make a little bit more sense? You're trying to create an open circuit, a real choking of the RF. The RF is going to flow down the first inch of the coax cable until it hits that RF choke, and it goes no further. And the first inch gives you no grief. KD2HUC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I got it. So in the best case, you always try and keep it right there at the dipole.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks for the info, Dick. I appreciate it.
You got it. Make sure you don't answer that question next week.
It's a good question, and it bears repeating because lots and lots of people misunderstand this concept. You want the number of wavelengths between the antenna and the RF choke to be a small fraction of one wavelength if you want maximum performance out of the RF choke. You put it one wavelength downrange, and then you've got one wavelength of radiating cable as well as connected electronically to a half-wave dipole, and it's going to disturb the resonance. It's going to change your antenna pattern. It's not going to stop your operation, but it's less than desirable. You've carefully oriented that dipole to radiate in certain directions with certain polarity. To have extraneous radiation going on from your transmission line might be undesirable. It's in some other direction. It might even be lighting up the neighbor's television set, if you know what I mean. So this is a better way of doing it. The next person on our list was some guy named John, KC2WGB, and directional couplers are one of his favorite subjects these days. The way we teach our electronic engineers how a directional coupler works leaves a lot to be desired. The schools do not cover it very well, if at all. The books do a mediocre job. And so the experiments that I have done and now John is doing on directional couplers, it's a very simple circuit. Properly used, boy, there are times when it can perform magic. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Yes, I have a 10 dB coupler and operating on its proper frequency. My question is, if I were to put a 0 dBm signal into the sample output port, what signals at the input and output or through ports of the directional coupler? So if it's, let's say it's a 1 gig directional coupler, put a 0 dBm signal into that sample port, what is going to be the amplitude of the signal, and will there be a phase difference at the end of that port, if you understand that question?
I sure do, John. Arguably NARDA, N-A-R-D-A.
Having my dessert.
Which is now owned by another company.
Having my dessert.
It is one of the best manufacturers of directional couplers. The directional coupler, if you actually took it apart, it really is built most of the time as a tri-plate strip line assembly. In other words, there's a flat upper plate, a flat lower plate, and they have they're parallel to each other, and roughly halfway between the two is a strip of metal, and that is a straight-through conductor with a type-N connector on the left side and a type-N connector on the right side. So you pour a signal down that strip line. Parallel to that strip line is another strip line with a carefully selected spacing between the first one. It's a quarter wavelength long, and depending on that spacing, you can make this coupler a 6 dB coupler, a 10 dB coupler, a 20 dB coupler, and so on. Increasing the spacing gives you less coupling. In John's particular case, it's got a 10 dB directional coupler. In other words, if he did put 0 dBm down the straight-through line, and he now looks at the sample port, and he's got it arranged in such a way that the sample port is monitoring the signal flowing from J1, the input connector, to J2, the output connector. So the signal going from left to right, in my mental diagram, is being sampled by the coupled port of the coupled line, and that's going to send a signal 10 dB weaker. That's why it's called the 10 dB directional coupler. It's called the 10 dB directional coupler because in the example I just given you, signal flowing from left to right will give you a 10 dB weaker signal out of the sampling port. A signal flowing in the other direction, right to left, gives you nothing. If it's an ideal directional coupler, let me drop. If it's an ideal directional coupler and it has real directivity, it will not respond to a signal flowing in the opposite direction on the straight-through line. Directional coupler does not have any nonlinear components, no amplifiers. Therefore, it must obey reciprocity and superposition. Let's talk about reciprocity. You put 0 dBm into the J1 port, the sampling port, I'm going to call it J3, you'll see a minus 10 dBm signal out of the J3 port. In other words, the J1 port and the J3 port are coupled to each other with what looks like a 10 dB attenuator but it really is the directional coupling factor. In reality, a 10 dB coupler is really allowing you to sample 10% of the energy flowing straight through, and 90% of the energy will continue to flow through out of the J2 port. It obeys the laws of conservation of energy. If you pour the 0 dBm into the J2 port, the backwards direction, you'll have exactly 90% again coming out of the J1 port. Now you're about to ask, where did the 10% power go? It still went into the directional coupler line, but the other end of the directional coupler line, internally to the directional coupler, has a 50 dB termination. That's where the signal in the other direction goes, if you've got high directivity. So in either case, 90% of the power flow is through the straight through line in either direction. But if it's in the desired direction, let me drop it. For the signal flowing in the desired direction, 10% of it comes out of the J3 sampling port. In the wrong direction, the 10% of the energy goes into the internal termination. A directional coupler always couples signal in either direction under the directional line, but in a very specific direction.
Explain what happens when you terminate it with 25 ohms.
You're changing the problem. Let's go to this one first. His original question is now we're going to use it backwards. Because it obeys reciprocity. If instead of putting signal on the straight through line, I now put a signal onto the coupled line, the sampling line, the J3 line of termination, J3 port of my particular example, it still has a 10 dB insertion loss between the coupled line and the straight through line. And the coupling between the straight through line and the coupled line that you can see from the outside of the box is only between J1 and J3. I put 0 dBm into the sampling port J3, a minus 10 dBm signal will come out of J1. No signal will come out of J2 if the coupler has high directivity. If it's a quality coupler, all of the signal comes out of the input connector when you put signal into the sampling port, and the insertion loss, whether you use it in the backwards mode or the that John is talking about now versus the original mode, it's still got 10 dB of loss if it's a 10 dB coupler. So as you can see, whatever connections it has internally, when you use it in a normal manner and when you use it in an abnormal manner, you have the exact same connections with the exact same insertion loss. Does that make, before we go on to these other problems, does that make some sense so far, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, Don, good question.
KC2WGB, yes, you've got it right. So in other words, or in those exact words, if we put the 0 dBm into that sampling port, which you're calling J3, J1 will have a minus 10 dB signal. On the other port, which would be J2, there should be nothing there if the directivity is proper.
Rich, as I often say, give that man a cigar, so that when you measure the real signal strength out of the J2 port, in your example, you're going to see, instead of minus 10, you're going to see minus 30, or minus 40. Minus 30 if it has 20 dB of directivity. A medium good quality directional coupler has roughly 20 dB of directivity. A very good one would have 30 dB of directivity. That's what I would call a high grade. There is an instrumentation grade directional coupler, which can be bought at cases. I own one of those, which has more than 50 dB of directivity. In other words, the signal flowing in the wrong direction is 50 dB weaker than the signal flowing in the right direction in a very high quality instrumentation grade directional coupler. So you can, with a little bit of tweaking, if you want to, at your favorite frequency, you can take almost any directional coupler. You can force it to have 50 dB of directivity. And I've written an article on that subject. You go to those articles by K2RIW. Let me drop a quick. On either the Mic 1 or the Mic 2 website, Mic 1 is amateur radio, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And there you'll find some articles by K2RIW. And also, if you go to mic number 2, which is LimeOnTechNet.com, that's the website. site of K1MJM, you'll also find these articles by K2RIW. And one of those articles is labeled using a directional coupler for VISWR and power measurement and how to calibrate the thing and what it really does. And there's an addendum to that article that tells you how to take your mediocre-grade directional coupler and make it instrumentation-grade, maybe across the whole band, but at least at your favorite frequency. It's a hell of a lot easier than you think. It just takes some understanding of what's going on inside of a directional coupler. It is such a high-performance, passive, inexpensive component. Let me drop. These real beautiful-looking blue objects with three type-N connectors on them that you see at flea markets, which Nada sold them originally for $1,000 or $1,500, and you see them on a flea market for $5, $10, and $15, and even though they've got the wrong frequency range on it, that's an extremely valuable item, in my opinion, because of a lack of education of most of our technologists on what that is and how to use it. The average guy just walks by the table saying, why the hell would I want that? You'd be amazed how useful that is as a test tool for sampling what's going on in your transmitter, for allowing your plus 20 dBm maximum power meter plug, what do you call it now, the detecting device, can only take maximum of plus 20 dBm, and you're trying to test a kilowatt transmitter. By using the right grade and the right quality and the right type of directional coupler, you can easily sample what's coming out of your transmitter, what's going to the antenna, how much is reflecting back from the antenna without overloading your instrumentation that you own. And to build your own homebrew directional coupler, there are cases where just putting a little gimmick piece of wire inside of the transmitter with a terminating resistor on it is all you need to do that. Once you understand the principle, it might take a dollar's worth of components for you to be able to sample with high quality and high accuracy what is your kilowatt transmitter doing today. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. That's interesting because now, from what you're telling me, I can determine the directivity of that directional coupler by making that simple test, putting the 0 dB in at the port 3 and measuring it port 1, comparing that to what's going to be coming out of port 2, and I can use that as determination of the directivity. And you're saying 30 dB to 50 dB, 50 dB quality grade type. That is a very simple test, and it sure makes it a lot easier. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Eric recognized. There's a catch here, though, John. When you're doing the test for directivity, you're extremely vulnerable to what is the reflection coefficient of your terminations. When I'm measuring forward directivity, I'm normally putting a signal into J1, and I normally get the signal out of J2, and J3, my sampling port, my directional port, I'll measure 10 dB down. And if I now flip the directional
port, my
if I flip the coupler upside down, and I'm applying the signal into
applying the signal on what through,
and I'm trying to find out what comes out in the wrong direction. I would like it to be 20 dB weaker. That will only be true if the termination I put on the J1 port absorbs all the signal. If I have a rather poor termination on J1, when I'm putting a signal into J2, some of the signal flowing down the straight through line hits that termination because the termination is mediocre in quality. Some signal reflects off the termination. The signal reflecting off the termination in that reverse test will now be a forward-going signal, and that forward-going reflected signal from the termination gets sampled by the coupling port, the sampling port, and you're going to see a signal there, and you're going to get a pessimistic answer. So when you're doing a directivity test, no matter how you do the directivity test, if you don't have a high-quality termination for the ports that you're not using at that instant, you'll get a rather pessimistic result. You got to worry about the quality of your terminations when you're doing a directivity test. If I'm looking for 50 dB of directivity and I'm getting a 20 dB minus signal of reflection off my terminations, I'm going to get almost a 30 dB error.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm going to get an almost 30 dB error in the measurements I make. You see what's going on there, John? The directivity measurements are rarely any better than the reflection coefficient of the terminations you use. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, what I plan to do, I have so many spectrum analyzers I could plug, and they're good quality. I could plug those into port 1 and 2, and feed the 0 dBm signal into port 3, and that should give me a very good match at 50 ohms. What do you think?
Eric recognized, I'm going to get to you in a second. Yes and no. It's a good test, and now by looking at the two spectrum analyzers and looking at the ratio of the signals between the two, that is a pretty good indication of directivity of the coupler. If and only if the coax cable going from that port on the directional coupler into your analyzer has no visual on that cable, nothing funny going on with its connectors, and if the input impedance of the spectrum analyzer is really 50 ohms. Take a look at the spec for the VISWAR rating of the input port of your spectrum analyzer. It might have a VISWAR rating of 1.4 to 1, if you know what I mean. Depending on how its RF front end attenuator is set. If you set it at 0, you can easily see a 2 to 1 VISWAR on the input end of the spectrum analyzer, because you're looking straight into a mixer. And depending on whether you set the RF attenuator on the front end of the analyzer at 10, 20, or 30 dB of attenuation, and you measure the S11, the reflection coefficient, of the input of that connector, of that analyzer, you'll see three different readings. The way the RF attenuator goes between a 10 dB step, a 20 dB step, and a 30 dB step, it's bringing into play different internal attenuator components, resistors, pads, whatever, of its attenuator assembly. Each one will have its own individual S11 reflection coefficient. Ain't that crazy, Eric? I mean, John, KC2WGB, KQIW.
KQIQ is kind of.
Glad we're in contact. All right. Yeah, and then I was thinking about maybe put two 10 dB pads to eliminate that problem, but I think I'd be better off with going with a high-quality terminator and then make those measurements that way, because, you know, the high qualities are good up to 18 gig, and I think that would probably be the stable way to make that measurement from what you're saying.
Yeah, we've got Eric and Glenn in that order who want to make comments on this. When you put in a 10 dB attenuator, you're going in the right direction. What's the quality of that attenuator? Depending on who you bought that 10 dB attenuator from, the attenuator itself, into a perfect termination on the output of the attenuator, it might have an input standing wave ratio of 1.2 to 1. It might have a 20, 25 dB reflection coefficient of the 10 dB attenuator. Everything you touch, when you're doing this kind of testing, when you're looking for signals of very low reflection coefficients, everything you touch, the piece of coax cable you use for testing, the quality of it, the quality of the 10 dB pad, the quality of the RF attenuator in the front end of the analyzer, the VISWAR rating of the analyzer. All of these are things that you can measure, and there's ways you can get around these, but you have to accept the fact that everything that you touch in the RF world has a reflection coefficient. The only thing left to find out is it a big one or a small one? If the reflection coefficient is minus 50 dB, you're in Fat City. If the reflection coefficient of your component is minus 10 dB, you're going to get some pretty crazy measurements at times. And that's the direction where Eric is going right now. He's about to find out what happens if I put a 25 ohm resistor at the output end. I think that's what he's about to ask. KE2EJ, KQIW, go ahead, Eric.
No, you're pretty much coming in, but what I wanted to do is get you to left out in your explanation of how the directional coupler works, that is based on input and output that provides a perfect termination, okay, and the 25 ohm resistor, when John said he was going to put it into the output port, not the sample port, I'm going to run the signal backwards here. If you put a 25 ohm resistor, which is going to be easier for people to understand, because we would think absorb all the energy being fed to it if it was a perfect termination. By the way, source termination of Gene Sense and mode termination of Gene is nearly perfectly equal for everything to work out perfectly. But if you put the 25 ohm resistor at the input port as the termination, and I wanted you to show what would come out of the sample port. But now we're picking up the energy that's traveling the reverse direction and coming out of the sample port. By the way, in the broadcast world, we tend to use DNAs or return loss meters to test all of everything before we start, because the directional couplers that we use on the transmission line is built into the transmission line have around 30-35 units of directivity. They're pretty good, but you have to make sure that the actual coupling is whatever the value is that it's set. You can actually adjust that these directional couplers work by increasing and decreasing the distance from the sending conductor in the hardline cable that we use in 3 inches or 8 inches thick, so it's got plenty of room to play. It's where our WKG is going.
Yeah, Eric, you're about to hear an answer to your question that's going to surprise you. Let's assume now I'm putting a signal into the J1 port, and the J2 port is the output port of a straight-through line, J3 is the sampling port, and the sampling port is set up in such a way of this particular directional coupler that it's a 10 dB coupler coupling what flows into J1 toward J2, and 10 dB down will come out of the sampling port to J3. So it's measuring forward power. And while I'm doing that measurement, I've got a good termination on J2. I now put a lousy termination on J2. Instead of 50 ohms, I put 25 ohms. What happens? 25 ohms, by definition, is a...
That's not what I was talking about.
Okay. If you do it in the other direction, you're again going to be surprised at what happens. You want me to put a 25 ohm resistor on J1, but I'm applying a signal on J2. Was that your test? Go ahead.
I know what happens. I just wanted to show, in John's example, what happens in terms of the energy that's going to come out of the sample port. Because as you explained it, if you feed into J2 and you terminate at J1 and you look at the sample port, you're going to see zero. Now you put a 25 ohm resistor at J1, what do you see at the sample port, which is J3? I know. Now explain it.
I'm going to backtrack one step. Once you have understanding of the way a coaxial cable works, which is, by the way, any kind of a medium, free space, waveguide, coax cables, they all are thoroughly independent in the way they behave to a signal that goes from left to right versus right to left. So the signal flowing in either end is a thoroughly separate event. So we're applying a signal, let's call it 0 dBm, into J2. The output port. And we know that the signal flowing into J1 under normal circumstances is going to be 90% because this is a 10 dB coupler. 10% of the power comes out of the sample port when it's in the forward direction. Turns out even in the reverse direction, it still has that same 90% flow through, which I think is in the vicinity of, is that 0.5 dB loss or the 1 dB loss, in that order. It's going to have a little bit of insertion loss, a calculatable amount of insertion loss, knowing that 90% of the power is going to flow through. Now, instead of a perfect termination on J1, instead of a signal flowing straight through in the reverse direction, being thoroughly absorbed at J1, because you put a 2-to-1 VizWar there, a 25 ohm resistor, a 25 ohm resistor, a 2-to-1 VizWar, the power reflected from a 2-to-1 VizWar is very close to 9.5 dB. So the 0 dBm signal goes down to 90% signal. Let me make that half a dB of loss. I'm rounding off the numbers. So minus 0.5 dB goes into the termination. The termination, 25 ohms, with a 9.5 dB reflection coefficient, reflects the signal 9.5 dB weaker than minus 5 to minus 10. So a minus 10 signal reflecting off your 25 ohm resistor is now flowing in the so-called forward direction of the straight through line. The coupling line is going to pick up 10 dB less of it. You're going to measure minus 20 in this example.
Repeater, timeout.
We're going to measure minus 20 dBm if and only if the directional coupler has high directivity. Now, here's the next step of what really happens. Once you measure the real directivity of your coupler, has got 20 dB of directivity. That means the signal flowing in one direction is attenuated by 10 dB, the signal flowing in the other direction is attenuated by 30 dB, 20 dB weaker. That's what 20 dB of directivity means. Because of 20 dB of directivity, some of the original signal, the 0 dBm, flowing down the cable, was going to be by directivity coming into the sampling port, 10 dB down, and 20 dB of directivity. It's going to be a minus 30 dBm signal. So there will be a minus 30 dBm signal. Before the signal gets to that 2 to 1, 50, 25 ohm resistor, there's a minus 30 dBm signal on the sampling port. By way of the mathematics I just told you about, the reflection gives you a minus 20. The minus 20 is going to beat against the minus 30. Depending on whether it's in phase or out of phase, you're going to get about another plus or minus dB of error. And there's ways you can find out whether or not it's in phase or out of phase by changing the line length that goes to that 25 ohm resistor. If you change the line length of the trombone to the 25 ohm resistor, the signal you're picking up at the sample port will have a slight wiggle to it. It'll average at minus 20 dBm, but it will wiggle plus or minus a fraction of a dB because of the finite directivity of the coupler. I've seen all of these effects. Once you understand the step-by-step procedure of what's going on inside, you're able to see mentally what's happening. You don't have to memorize a whole bunch of individual equations, if you know what I mean.
Okay, one.
What if that answer is a little bit different than you expected? Eric is going to give us an answer, then Glenn in that order, and then whoever the third person is. KE2EJ, KQRIW. Good question, Eric.
Now, if you're short, J1, you send back all the signal that's being sent down. Do the math. Get the output. Again, as you said, you change the range, short, and the body of the directional coupler, and change the phase.
Yeah, along the lines of what you just said, Eric, put a short circuit at J1 when you're applying a signal at J2. First of all, the signal that got to the short circuit is a 90% signal. It's about time I set up my my log scale here and find out exactly what that assertion loss is. I think it's around half a dB. Stand by. It's 0.457 dB. Let's call it 0.5 dB. So, the signal going down the straight through line, coming from J2 to J1, because the insertion loss of the directional coupler is the same in either direction on the straight through line. That directional line is always picking up a signal. In one direction, the signal comes out of the sampling port and you see the sampled signal. In this example, 10 dB down. In the wrong direction, you don't see the sampled signal per se, but it's going into the internal termination. So you've got half a dB of insertion loss, roughly, of the signal going from J2 to J1. It hits the short circuit. All of it reflects. Now that reflected signal is minus 0.5 dB by definition, and 10 dB down from that, the sampling port is going to see that reflected signal that's now going back down the line in the other direction. So you're going to see minus 10.5 in that particular example, if you had high directivity. In this particular case, because the signal reflected off that short circuit is so strong, unless you're lousy directivity, the plus or minus little bit of in phase and out of phase of finite directivity is going to almost cut.
Body out here, I have to get those bodies,
the eyes. Pretty much of a problem in this particular case. Is that the answer you expected to see, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Big
problem.
Yes, I am. This just kind of illustrates how all the things that are in your paper. Typically, most people don't think of it, but the SWR bridge is simply a directional coupling.
Hey, please come over here and change my body bar.
It turns out every coupler is a dual directional coupler. You could, as long as you've got a quality termination in your hand that you're willing to put on the J3 or J4 port, that internal termination. On some couplers, they bring it to you to the outside world, and you could decide whether your coupler, without having to reverse the hold-on coupler in the system,
you can now decide whether you're going to look at the J3 port or the J4 port, because you brought out that termination, and now you can look at the signal in either direction or both signals simultaneously. So you can buy a dual directional coupler in one particular package that's built that way. And it also is another way of building to have literally two separate directional lines parallel to the main straight through line and two separate output ports. There's multiple ways you can do it. I know that Glenn wanted to make a comment on this. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Bonnie, change my diaper. Patty's not around.
You're very good, Vic. I think you covered most of the ground. It's just the only two comments I just wanted to add on top of that was very good coverage of directional couplers, by the way. But generally, back in the day when I used to check directional couplers, we always used like a network analyzer. And network analyzer, we would always normalize through the through port. So we go through the low insertion most through port and normalize the network analyzer over the, in the Taylor mode, you know, from one end to the other, so it'd be a 0 dB normalized. Then basically use 30 dB pad to somewhere between a 30 or a 50 dB pad, which would have basically double the attenuation of the pad would be the return loss. So if you had like a 30 dB pad, typically you could have like between 50 and 60 dB of return loss, which is very good for VSWR for the unterminated ports. And you could use those as your terminators, and that usually worked out very well, Dick. And then you could just get the throughput measurement by going between any ports and either measure the directivity or the forward insertion loss of any over wide band of frequency that the network analyzer, which worked out very nicely. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, if you had some kind of a power sensing system on the sampling port of a directional coupler, and you want to find out, is the total system acting in a linear manner? You think it's got a 10 dB directional coupler, you think it's got high directivity, and you want to test it. One way of doing the test would be to put various amounts of termination on the J2 port while putting a constant signal under the J1 port. And so putting a perfect termination, a termination with the 10 dB, 20 dB, 30 dB restriction coefficient would be one way of calibrating the system. One of the nice things you can do with an attenuator is to recognize the fact that under normal circumstances, you use an attenuator where you start off with a 50 ohm source impedance into the input of the attenuator, and you put a 50 ohm load on the output of the attenuator. The next question is, what happens if you don't put that load there? If you leave it an open circuit, or if you put a perfect short circuit on the output of the attenuator. Now that you recognize the fact that signal flowing forward and signal flowing reverse on a coaxial cable are thoroughly independent events that do not mix with each other RF-wise. With your instrumentation, you may think they're mixing, particularly on a slotted line. Let me drop. But they really don't mix. So you know that the signal flowing through your 10 dB pad, for instance, goes into a short or an open circuit. In either case, essentially all of that signal reflects back. The signal got 10 dB weaker getting to that short or open circuit. All of it reflects back, goes through the attenuator a second time in the reverse direction. It's now a 20 dB weaker signal. So a 10 dB pad as a termination is by definition a 20 dB reflection coefficient if the pad is perfect. Your 10 dB pad with a perfect termination may itself not be exactly a 50 ohm load, but we'll assume it is. So a 6 dB pad will give you a 12 dB reflection coefficient into an open circuit. A 10 dB pad gives you 20 dB, a 30 dB pad gives you 60 dB, and so on. Whatever the number of decibels on the pad is into a short or an open circuit, the reflection you get from the pad is twice the number of dB printed on the front end of that pad, if the pad is of high quality. And so that's a handy way of, now, if you use pads in combination with, say, a T connector and a pair of 50 ohm terminations, a pair of 50 ohm terminations on a T connector, on the common port of the T connector, by definition, you're going to see 25 ohms. 25 ohms is a 2-to-1 VSWR. 2-to-1 VSWR is 6.5 dB reflection coefficient. So when you put together combinations like T connectors, terminations, pads, shorts and opens on the pads, with very simple laboratory instrumentation, you can create a whole lot of mathematically definable reflection coefficients in order to calibrate your VNA-like system. In the case of what Glenn was discussing, let me drop it.
I think his network analyzer maybe was a scalar network analyzer. In other words, it measured amplitudes of reflection signals, but not necessarily phase angles. And I think that might have been something to do with why you put a directional coupler into the test cable of your analyzer, so that now you could see signals, you could measure the amplitude of signals flowing forward and reverse out of the test port of your analyzer. A well-made analyzer will make that measurement for you internally. I wonder why you wanted to supplement it with an external directional coupler, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was just explaining, if I have a directional coupler on the bench and I just don't know what it is, it has no markings on it, and I have a basic idea of what frequencies I'm interested in, and I set up my scalar network analyzer between my two frequency test points, and at first I normalize the throughput, so it's basically 30 dB, and then I put the cal pads on the
where the coupled line is a quarter wavelength long.
that first null that you hear beyond, see beyond that first peak of the rectified sine wave is where the coupled line is a half wavelength long. The next peak is where the half wavelength line, where the coupled line is three quarters of a wavelength long. And oh, by the way, that three quarters of a wavelength response on your directional coupler does not have directivity. So you get beautiful directivity in that first peak of that sine wave of the display. And you can go to all the frequencies from that peak down towards 0 megahertz. And it will behave, if it's a well-designed coupler, and a reasonable design coupler, it'll have a very mathematically predictable performance all the way down to 0 hertz. And I'm not kidding. Let me drop the mic. And the slugs, all of the slugs per se, in your bird wattmeter, are a directional coupler where the coupled line is considerably less than a quarter wavelength long. That coupled line in the slug does not have a flat response. It is falling off at almost exactly 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency because that coupled line is electronically too short. It's coupled to that straight-through line of your bird. When you open up the slug and you look down there, you see this great big 5/8 of an inch diameter straight-through line. The straight signal flowing through there, you're picking up a sample of that with the slug, and it is a very directional thing where you can measure forward power and reverse power. That 6 dB per octave falloff is compensated by the slug having a low-pass filter that rolls up at 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. Therefore, across an octave or two, the roll-up of the low-pass filter and the roll-down of the coupling line of the slug match each other, and across a defined frequency region, you now get a calibrated performance. The slug might say it runs from 100 to 250 megahertz. That's the region over which those two factors, the slope of the coupled line and the slope of the filter, match each other. Can you measure watts? Let me drop it. Can you measure watts outside of that frequency range? Absolutely. But you now got to do another calibration procedure. It is not going to give you calibrated performance. If the slug says it's good for 100 to 250 megacycles, can you make a measurement at 90, 80, 60, 50, 10 megacycles? Absolutely. But you now know you're going to be getting a roll-off of the coupled line that's probably running out of the range of the low-pass filter, and therefore the performance is going to require another calibration procedure. But you can do that. And so you may find out that your 100 to 250 meg slug gives you 10% lower performance when you're making the measurement at 90 megacycles. Therefore, from then on, you can make measurements at 90 megacycles if that's what you want to do. Anybody with any further comments on what we've had so far on couplers, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Not really. Let's move on to something else.
I believe Wes had a comment.
Go ahead, Wes.
Let's move on to something else, please.
I didn't have a comment. The cockroach that is next to me.
Let's go to the mailbag, John. KC2WTB, K2RIW. Have we gotten some tough questions this week, John?
KC2WTB. Oh, real slow week. Dick. All right, I have a gentleman, Chris, W2. He has a question. If anybody has any information on a particular type of transmitter, let me let it drop. This transmitter, he believes, transmits between 902 or 24 gigs, somewhere in that area, and it's used for monitoring meters, like gas meters, like that. And it's supposed to be a wake-up meter, where when the truck comes down the line, it would send a pulse, and the meter repeats out its information. But he notices with his instrumentation placed near the meter, every 30 seconds, there is a pulse coming out of this device. Now his question is, it's a major intrusion to his life, he believes, but he's worried about the safety factor. Being that this thing is transmitting every 30 seconds, sort of like cell phone, we we always get these questions on cell phone and the biohazards, and that's what he's interested in. So maybe you could fill him in on how those things work and your opinion on the amount of hazard. KC2, WGB, back to you, Dave.
I'm fairly sure you're about to find out that the amount of hazard is extremely small. In the case of a really great big piece of hardware, it's $750,000 worth of hardware, probably 50,000 or 150,000 pounds of stuff, 150-foot high tower with a zillion antennas on it, and a little clubhouse below the tower with all of the electronics, and then $500,000 worth of electronics. I'm talking about a cell site. A cell site, in many cases, has got 3, 6, 12, a whole lot of antennas. And during drive time, you've got a whole lot of transmitters running roughly 30 watts of power in the various directions, filling up all those cell phones. And there are people who will say, I don't want that cell site in my community. I don't want the radio frequency biohazard. I don't want my kids to be getting cancer because of the RF radiation of that cell site. We jump. And I visited a meeting that was held a couple of months ago in Ronkonkoma, and Paul knows about this particular situation, where a cell phone company, I think it's T-Mobile, wants to put a cell site set of antennas at roughly the 130-foot level of a high-tension tower. In other words, you've got one of these what used to be called Loco towers. You've got 130 kilovolt three-phase line, I think a pair of them, on this 130-foot high Loco tower, which is on a right-of-way going through Ronkonkoma. And at the top of that tower, they want to put a cell site. And the homes that are on the long side of that right-of-way feel that they're going to be getting RF radiation. And they're petitioning for the last 6 months to make sure that that doesn't happen. And they're going to lose that battle because there is a dead spot for the cell phone coverage in that area, and T-Mobile wants to put an antenna there. The FCC is in strong agreement. The town is essentially in agreement, but there's probably about 50 people in Ronkonkoma that meet periodically and protest. Let me drop this. And so this situation and Chris's situation, W2TEC, have a degree of similarity. The defining document for the United States is the ANSI report, ANSI, American National Standards Institute. You Google the word ANSI and C95. It's called the C95 report. The C95 report represents approximately 60 years of study of RF radiation and the effects on human beings. It started in the late 40s, and it gets updated every couple of years. All of the advanced nations in the world have a similar document. The Department of Radiological Health in the United Kingdom has a similar document with 60 years of history. And so does Scandinavia, so does Japan, so does Australia, and so on. All the developed nations have been doing approximately a 60-year study. You look at the American study, which, by the way, has very strong correlation with all the other studies of all those other nations. So it's not that they all hang together. They're all doing independent studies that just happen to be coming up with essentially the exact same answer. Let me drop this. The American C95 report has roughly 1,000 references that represent the best institutions and testing laboratories in the United States doing these kind of measurements for 60 solid years. It is the defining document for the whole darn United States, for the Department of Defense, for the NIOSH and OSHA. Any of these organizations that are trying to regulate RF radiation have to go back to that document. It is the defining document for this nation. And you can go to the one in Japan, you can go to the one in the United Kingdom, and the one in Scandinavia, and you're going to get very similar results. You study that document. I'll admit to you ahead of time, it's written in fairly deep technical language, not an easy document to understand. You may need somebody, an engineering person, to help you define what you're reading, what you're seeing. When you look at those graphs, you look at those equations, you look at all of these references, and you look at all those paragraphs. But here's the bottom line from my point of view. Let me drop this. Even though the document started in the late 40s, the real problem began at roughly 1900.
when mankind started studying radio around the time of Marconi and all these other guys, they discovered that when you put a radio signal into an antenna, the signal radiates the signal in all directions.